Well, then, as opposed to me then asking specific questions, because I'm sure maybe in your conversations around the country already about the album, you've said what does occur to you about certain songs. Let me just ask you to, you know, talk about a couple of them. Fill Me Up is the single, and I don't think it's one that I had heard in the summertime last year. How did that evolve for you, and what's the feel for you in that one?
Fill Me Up was a track that John gave me, and as you hear it on the record, it was a finished piece with no melody or anything. And I knew immediately that it was something I wanted to work on. And it was one of the songs that when I went into Cedar Creek Studios in March of 2005 and just started trying to work on things, that I started that song. And I think the first verse happened fairly immediately. And it was, I think I had written the words fill me up somewhere, and that's all I had. And then that just, the process of working in that studio that week was taking a notebook full of things I had jotted down and trying to be open to what might fit in where. And so I just started that way, and then I had some other things jotted down from a time that I spent with John in New York that had to do, you know, just things I'd messed around with that became the verses. And, you know, the song to me is pretty straightforward about, I don't know, kind of being on the road. And it's just kind of a, I don't know, a lighthearted overview of the way my life works, I guess.
Is the audience filling you up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I included that among the thoughts that I had about that.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, you know.
Yeah, but it could also, it can also apply, you know, to relationships and kids and so much. So that's interesting about that.
Yeah, it can. It can apply to a lot of things. And, you know, it's my daughter's in that one too, you know.
Yeah.
Fill Me Up.
So a lot of people, I think, listening to Tough Kid are going to make a leap and say, okay, well, here's as close to autobiography as we could get from Sean recently. And what would you tell folks who asked you that question?
Yeah, Tough Kid's autobiographical. It's just, you know, it's another... I almost didn't want to go there, you know. It's like, oh. But it just kind of came out, you know, and it's just another little snapshot of me as a kind of a teenager being mad at my parents, you know, and having a good time with my friends. That's, you know, it was really a great time, you know, all in all. But I was so mad at my poor folks. You know, I obviously still am on some level, but we all take it with a grain of salt at this point. You know, it's not so much a bloodletting, it's just a little snapshot, and, you know, I thought, you know, it could be a Steve Earle-esque type tune, you know, there's nothing too earth-shattering about it.
It's a great, great riff, too. It does remind me that I didn't ask you, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I didn't really ask you much about growing up in South Dakota. You know, I was rereading your essay in that solo book, and you'd wrote that honesty was being suppressed everywhere I looked. It seemed like everyone was wearing a mask. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit to me and talk a little bit about how, you know, I mean, you said you were angry, you know, but we haven't really talked about that phase of your life very much in terms of your overall story.
Well, here's how I see it now. I was the type of kid, and my daughter's the same way, and you know, getting to know her and getting inside her head is, you know, gives me some insight into really what was going on when I was growing up. And I was just the kind of kid and the kind of person that was really ultra sensitive to stuff. I mean, I got my feelings hurt easily. Stuff scared me. I wanted a lot of explanation. I wanted a lot of reassurance. I was just a really anxious kid, and my imagination, you know, ran wild. And there were really great things about that, but I wanted I wanted a lot of talk, and I wanted frank talk. You know, I wanted I wanted this life explained to me. You know, and I needed to go deep. You know, even then, and it just wasn't done. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. You know, it was a small box we lived in, and that's the way my parents were raised. And it was a very small provincial town in the Midwest. And you know, you kept yourself in check with religion and morality, and you know, that just didn't do it for me. It didn't work. So I think that's what I was trying to say when I talked about people being dishonest or feeling that there were masks. I think those were people's coping mechanisms, but I couldn't relate to it as such. You know, I thought it was a bunch of bullshit. Mm-hmm. And in a way it is, but now that I'm grown up, I realize, you know, you got to have your defenses in place to get through the day. And I think art, you know, tends to blow doors open and open windows, and you know, we just didn't go there. So when, you know, when that's why I was so into my parents' record collection, and when the Beatles happened, it was a, you know, it was a place to go and get more of that emotion. And then, you know, when I finally moved to New York, that was a godsend, you know, because, you know, it was fairly commonplace for everybody to be wanting to uncover things, I guess. Mm-hmm. And art was everywhere, and the pursuit of that kind of thing was common, and that's what I was looking for.
Right. It seems to explain rather neatly why at the age of 14 or so, someone like Joni Mitchell just really grabbed you by the ears, because of her authenticity and, you know, the reality of her lyricism.
Yeah, before Joni Mitchell, there had been others, you know. I mean, I was very into Simon and Garfunkel and James Taylor and the Beatles, of course. But I think Joni Mitchell to me was significant. Well, number one, because she's a genius and it was just phenomenal work. But the fact that she was female, you know, I think was, it was really a comfort, you know, because Laura Nyro before her was also important to me, but Laura Nyro was urban, you know, and almost ethnic, and it was fantastic stuff. I was in love with it, but I didn't see myself doing that, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to sing like that, and I wasn't going to write like that. I loved it. I was a huge fan. But Joni Mitchell was like, oh, you know, this is me. So it was very important.
Since you mentioned it, I was going to tack it on to the end of the interview, but let me go there now, because one of my next documentaries is on Paul Simon, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about him. I might use it for that special. But so, you know, the Simon and Garfunkel period, or discovering, you know, Paul Simon, do you sort of recall when you were first drawn to his music, and what do you think resonated with you about that? Early days, more, because we talked about his longevity and his skill as a songwriter as time's gone on, but I'm curious about the initial entry.
Well, I was aware of Paul Simon and Simon and Garfunkel right from the start. I remember the Sounds of Silence record, and I believe there was one before. And I remember the Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. I don't know what the first record was. If Sunday morning, 3 a.m. maybe.
Wednesday morning,
yeah, whatever. Yeah, so, yeah, from the Sounds of Silence album on, I was into Simon and Garfunkel and, you know, learned a lot of the tunes. I remember learning Flowers Never Been with the Rainfall. I remember, gosh, we did April Come She Will in choir, you know, when I was in 7th or 8th grade. And I played guitar. I mean, you know, they let us do that stuff. And so I loved that stuff from the beginning.
You recorded Kathy's song, or you used to do it in performance. It's on that Live 88 CD.
That song. I'll still do Kathy's song from time to time.
Didn't
especially
you just,
when it's if I'm at an outdoor gig and it's raining, I'll do it.
Didn't I see you do Only Living Boy too in New York?
Yeah, I've covered a lot of Paul Simon songs. I can do a lot. Yeah, Only Living Boy. I've done American Tune. I did a Music Cares thing to honor him in L.A. one year, and he was actually there, and I did American Tune. You know, it's just been in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so that I've kind of woken up to how important Paul Simon has been to me and how strong the body of his work is and how long he's been doing it. And, you know, it's just doesn't happen very often. And, you know, I feel as though, you know, to some extent we all got, or I should just speak for myself, got brainwashed slightly about Dylan being the, you know, the voice of the generation. And I think there's something to that. And they're, you know, they're different animals, and my appreciation for Dylan is vast. But I probably draw more on Paul Simon, you know. That's probably more in me, you know, than Dylan. And I just, I don't know, for some reason feel the need to draw a parallel between the two and almost take sides in a strange way, you know. Mm-hmm. It sounds dumb, or it sounds unnecessary, but I don't know. I just think he's that important. I think Paul Simon is that important that he should be mentioned in the same breath. And I think Dylan thinks so too.
Mm-hmm. Well, when other people write about Simon's early work, especially, you know, they particularly as it's coming out in that era of busting through facades, you know, he was. He was one of the folks writing about sort of alienation and the darkness and the, you know, the ambiguity and the confusion, you know, that was coming up. And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I'm just wondering if, you know, again, for a 14, 15-year-old looking for some truth or getting a sense that there was something, you know, that the rest of the world wasn't quite copping to, that, you know, that might have been seeping through his lyrics.
I'm sure the fact that he, you know, was willing to kind of go dark, Paul Simon, you know, was attractive to me. But there was just, there was a beauty, you know, in the writing and the melodies. And those harmonies, too, you know, were just beautiful. And he had some missteps early on. I mean, whereas Dylan sort of came out of the chute songwriting-wise just not missing a beat, you know, Paul Simon had some dodgy moments, you know, I think, initially, really flowery stuff, you know. Just a little bit, you know, just a little bit self-conscious, you know, like the dangling conversation or something. But you know, or even what was that one? Oh God, I can't remember. It was kind of a faux blues thing, you know, where he actually mentions Dylan. You know, like they think you're talking about Dylan Thomas.
Right.
That one, that was a little corny, but he you know, he got to the point where, in my opinion, that didn't happen anymore after a couple of records. You know, there's just a, you know, Paul Simon's got parts of, you know, I see why he did a Broadway show, you know. He's got Sondheim in him. He's got an unbelievable take on melody and chord progression and just beautiful, sophisticated stuff so often, as well as very simple classic stuff, too.
Well, thanks for those musings on that.